Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In March 2020, the COVID pandemic plunged American workers and the small businesses that employed them into what seemed to be a bottomless abyss. More than 14 million Americans would lose their jobs in the course of weeks as lockdowns forced thousands of businesses across the country to pull back or close. So Congress stepped in with one of the biggest relief programs ever, the Paycheck Protection Program.
Much of the CARES Act is still being implemented. But one key program is already up and running. It's the Paycheck Protection Program from Chairman Rubio, Chairman Collins, Senator Cardin, and Senator Shaheen. It gives small businesses emergency capital so that workers can keep getting paychecks instead of pink slips. Just a few days after the program opened for business, $100 billion in loans have already been committed. That is 30% of the total funding spoken for in just the first few days. Actually, that's very good news. It means this job-saving program is attractive to small business. Employers can access it. But it also means we need more funding, and we need it fast.
Senator Mitch McConnell on April 9th, 2020, just a day before House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said something similar.
I don't think that $350 is enough for small business, and I don't think that 8 weeks is enough of a time to make a judgment about the viability of the business and how long they keep on their employers. So I'd like to go right back and say, let's look at that bill, let's update it for what some other things that we need, and again, put money in the pockets of the American people.
The Paycheck Protection Program ended up topping $800 billion. So 2 years later, it's worth asking, did it work? Answer? Well, yes, mostly, but at extremely high cost. There's another question then, where did the money go? Well, 72% of PPP funds ended up with Americans whose household income is in the nation's top 20%. That's according to a new study recently circulated by the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's called the $800 Billion Paycheck Protection Program. Where did the money go and why did it go there? Now, there is quite a bit more behind that headline. And it's a lesson in how shifting goalposts can render noble efforts more expensive and perhaps less successful than they otherwise might have been. And David Otter led the 10-person team behind that paper. He's a professor of economics at MIT, and he joins us now. Professor Otter, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to start off first with some definitions here. The Paycheck Protection Program was intended to be relief for small businesses. And within the PPP's original rules, there's a link between small businesses and workers, right? Because businesses that receive PPP loans were required to basically use, in order for those loans to be forgiven, to use the majority of the funds to maintain employment at wages near pre-pandemic levels. And then secondly, as I see in your paper, it also matters because, 47% of U.S. workers are employed by these small businesses. So really, if you were going to say from the get-go, what was the goal of PPP? What would you say it was?
Sure. The name sort of suggests it's about protecting paychecks, which would suggest it's about maintaining employment. But of course, firms have other costs than just workers, and they couldn't simply pay their workers and not pay their suppliers or creditors or lenders and stay in business. So only 60% of the dollars in PPP actually had to be spent on paychecks and or on payroll, and the other 40% could be spent on other qualifying expenses. So I think if you kind of parse the legislation, you would say the money was intended to preserve employment. It wasn't intended that every dollar would go to a worker who otherwise would have lost their job, some that was meant to subsidize or support the rest of the cost of keeping a business open.
Okay. But just to be clear, though, that 60-40 ratio that you just said, was that in the second round of PPP funding? Because I thought the original portion that had to cover paychecks was higher, in 75% or so.
They changed the rules a number of times. So that's correct. That basically, the program was gradually loosened in terms of the criteria for achieving loan forgiveness, how much you had to spend on workers, how long you had to do it, at what point in time, what possibilities would allow you to not meet those criteria and still keep the money. And then ultimately, as well, in January 2021, Congress made the entire program tax deductible to the businesses that received it, an additional cost to taxpayers of more than $100 billion. And that had no incentive effects whatsoever. That was basically a windfall after the fact to businesses that had already taken loans.
Okay. So let's dig into some of your findings here. And the first one that I mentioned, the one that sort of caught a lot of people's attention, that the majority of PPP funds ultimately, and we'll discuss why, as you and your co-authors say, ended up in the hands of Americans whose household income is in the top 20% in this country. So how did that happen?
Sure. Well, the first thing to realize is that most of the PPP money didn't actually go to workers who otherwise would have lost jobs. So to make that determination, you need to kind of estimate how many jobs were preserved because of PPP. And we have a variety, and many authors, I should say, and I should say, a team of economists at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors and two economists who were formerly employees of ADP, the payroll processor, which provided the data that we use for a lot of the analysis. So determining the causal effect, what jobs were saved, means contrasting firms that were eligible or not eligible, or firms that got it early versus firms that got it late. So we have a variety of strategies. And we estimate that PPP preserved about 2 to 3 million person years of employment. Mm. That means one job for 1 year. Now, if it preserved two jobs for each for half a year, that's also a person year of employment. So the average cost of doing that was somewhere between $175,000 and $250,000 per job preserved. And of course, the median earnings of workers is more like $50,000.
Okay, so pause there for a second. So yeah. Let's disentangle a little bit of this. Yeah, so you're saying, yes, PPP preserved jobs.
It definitely did.
It succeeded there, but it cost three times as much to preserve those jobs.
Five times as much,
sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
To preserve
three to
those
five
jobs
times as much.
As the wages of those, the regular
exactly.
wages of those jobs.
Okay. Exactly. So just in enumerating it's what it succeeded in doing. It preserved 2 to 3 million person years of employment. It caused many small businesses to reopen faster than they otherwise would have. So we saw them shut down and then start to reopen again as the PPP money went out. It's very likely that it kept a small percentage of small businesses from closing permanently. It's actually hard to determine exactly, but the best work by researchers at BLS suggests that a few percentage points of businesses would have otherwise closed, but in fact remained open. But the flip side of all that is most businesses wouldn't have closed, and many wouldn't have reduced employment by very much. They weathered the storm. And so a lot of the PPP money went to firms that otherwise would have pretty much kept operating as they did, or would have had some contraction but wouldn't have closed down, or their expenses would have gone up, but not that much. And so the money was kind of a windfall for the businesses that received that income.
How much of it was that fell into that windfall category?
Somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters.
Two-thirds and three-quarters of the $800 billion you classify as essentially windfall profits.
That's right. And actually, let me even – so our paper is focused on the PPP loans that were made during 2020, which were $510 billion. There was a lot more money spent in 2021. We didn't try to account for that, but the best evidence we had is that money did nothing. In other words, it didn't actually preserve any businesses or jobs because it came very late in the game when the economy was already in a strong recovery. So that was that. If you were to include that, it would look kind of worse.
Okay. So this helps us understand what you said a little bit earlier, that of those jobs that were preserved by PPP, the cost of preserving those jobs was five times more than the actual wages of those jobs themselves.
Correct.
because of all the windfall that went to businesses that may not have necessarily needed it.
That's right. So it's important to emphasize, if you speak to people, small business owners, they say, yes, this preserved us, this saved us, it got us through the storm, it allowed us to restore employment, keep our workers on the payroll, we didn't have to close down. And that's all true. Those stories are true. And that's especially true for the smallest of businesses, those with 25 to 50 employees. But a lot of the money went to much larger firms that were not nearly in the same type of dire straits. And those firms didn't, they were not rescued. they were just happy to receive the money.
So, and then also because the rules changed over the course of the various versions of PPP, which we'll talk about in detail in a little bit, those loans were forgiven, essentially.
Oh, yes. So as of late 2021, 94% of PPP loans issued in 2020 had applied for and received forgiveness. So almost all the money, very, very little of the money will be repaid. It was just a cash transfer from future taxpayers to current business owners.
David Autor, in that sense, let me ask you the question. We have 30 seconds before the break here, but did PPP work? Did it achieve its initially stated goal?
It did achieve some of those goals. It would be incorrect to say it was ineffective. It was just extremely costly for what it did. And it was highly regressive in terms of where the money actually ended up going.
I mean, I'm looking at one of the charts you have here, you and your co-authors, in the paper, and it's the distribution of PPP, unemployment insurance, and stimulus check payments. Overall, you're lumping them all together in this chart, and by far, the vast majority of all that money together went to the top 20% of households in this country.
That's right, and that's almost all PPP. The other two programs, and I'd be happy to talk about those, were not nearly as regressive in their distribution of across households.
Okay. So when we come back, we're going to talk about how this happened. David Autor, professor of economics at MIT, stand by for just a moment. This hour, we're exploring where did the money go with the $800 billion Paycheck Protection Program. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at where did the money go with the $800 billion Paycheck Protection Program. And we're asking, did the money go in the places it was intended to? And what lessons can we learn in terms of efficient and effective distribution of emergency funds the next time a crisis like a pandemic befalls us all? And we've received a lot of comments and voicemails from listeners about this, because this is a program that reached more than 90% of American small businesses. I mean, we were hearing from Eric Bergeron on Facebook, who says, was there fraud and abuse? Of course. Many of those people were prosecuted. Did it save thousands of businesses and millions of jobs? Absolutely. And Ed Kowalski says, companies with big banks behind them tended to get paperwork in faster with larger payouts. Go figure. Well, here's Sherry, who called us from Seattle, and she said she had a great experience with PPP.
I received two small PPP loans and I am a sole proprietor alternative healthcare provider. I was very impacted by not being able to work, and the PPP loans helped me put food on the table. I'm really, really grateful for it.
That's Sherry from Seattle, Washington. Over in Creston, Iowa, Al Baker called us and he told us he owns a small business, got a PPP loan, but also said that in his view, he felt like the wealthier people were around him, the more money they got.
I went in to deliver to a bank some product. The loan officer asked me if I'd applied for a loan. I said, no, I don't need one. And he said, well, it's forgiven. So a month later, I had $27,000 cash, and I've looked in the county I live in, and it's amazing the people that got this money. A lot of it's farmers. The largest farmer, who is probably a millionaire, got four or five different loans totaling over $100,000. Totally ridiculous. And the other thing about it is it's a kind of a secret. Not everybody in town knows that people got these loans, and actually, the people that are more well off got more money. Just, I have no faith in the government anymore.
That's Al Baker, who called us from Creston, Iowa. I'm joined today by David Otter. He's a professor of economics at MIT. He led a 10-person team that examined lots of economic data from PPP and co-authored a paper that emerged from that analysis. It's called The Paycheck Protection Program. Where did the money go and why did it go there? And Professor Otter, hang on here for just a second because I want to bring in Lydia DePillis into the conversation. She joins us from Washington. She's a reporter at ProPublica who's been reporting extensively on PPP for a couple of years now. Lydia, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, help us understand sort of what you see in the first of Professor Otter's finding. He's essentially describing what sounds like a regressive relief program.
That's right. I mean, it's actually incredible to remember the size of the PPP program. Like $800 billion was nearly the size of the entire bailout from 2009, the American Reconstruction and Reinvestment Act. And it did some good, clearly. I don't think anyone wants to doubt that. It was a critical lifeline for many small businesses. I think the question that we are trying to highlight and have, I mean, gosh, it's incredible to imagine it's been a year and a half since we've been looking at this, but is where did money go that it didn't need to go, whether that was in the form of fraud or whether it was in the form of simply sort of abuse and bad targeting? And how could we do this better if we ever have a need to save businesses on such a large scale again?
Exactly. Okay. So David Otter, let me turn back to you. And Lydia, I'm going to keep hopping back and forth between the two of you because I want you to help us understand the data and analysis that Professor Otter is putting out here. Really, we're talking about a program that was created to flow through the structure of small businesses in the United States. And for all the reasons why we mentioned earlier in the A, that made a lot of sense. Almost half of Americans employed by small businesses. Economically, culturally, small business is very, very important in cities, in towns and cities across the whole country. But at the same time, I'm curious, Professor Otter, if that decision almost made it de facto that we were going to see the outcomes that you're describing simply because of the way that wage earners are skewed in the United States and how ownership is skewed in the United States. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. So first of all, nice to speak with Lydia as well. She's done a lot of valuable reporting on this, and I've learned from what she's written. So thank you. So when we talk about small businesses, important to remember that actually 99.7% of all U.S. businesses have 500 or fewer employees. So
we're talking about everybody.
It's the other case. The other 0.3% of businesses employ 55% of 45% of workers. They're huge, but these 500 people is not actually small by any rational definition. And in fact, there were exceptions made for fast food chains that had thousands of employees, but only fewer than 500 per establishment. Ted Cruz got some special breaks for oil extractors in his state, and so on. So it wasn't very targeted. In fact, Lydia said I think quite aptly, you know, how much of this is fraud, how much is abuse, and how much of it is bad targeting. And there's some of all of those things, but bad targeting is probably the most important one. In fact, you could say the program was essentially untargeted. All a firm had to do was to say that it was adversely affected, substantially adversely affected by the pandemic. There's no legal or formal definition of what that means. It had to claim that it was going to use the money to maintain employment. It had to claim that it had fewer than 500 employees. None of this was really verified. And so essentially every business from the most needy and most deserving to the least needy and least deserving all got checks. And the larger the business, the more money they got, and the larger businesses were much less adversely impacted. So if you were to take the PPP money and just divide it by individual citizens in the United States, it's about $2,000 per person in the U.S. However, only about 5 or 6 million PPP loans were made at an average cost of $1 million or so. So it was incredibly skewed. And the bigger the business, the larger the PPP payment, up to $10 million at a time. And so it was, in some sense, inevitable that much of the money would go to businesses that were not really in distress. And that means it didn't go to workers, per se, workers who would have otherwise lost their jobs. And as a consequence, since businesses are primarily owned by individuals who are affluent or people who own stock who are also affluent, that means that most of that windfall went to affluent households.
Okay, so hold that thought there, because I want to come back to this in a second. But Lydia, I do want to hear from you. I mean, you've been looking at this program in depth for much longer than I have. PPP, as we heard from both Senator McConnell and Speaker Pelosi at the top of the show, was meant to aid small businesses. No one's disputing that. So if it just so happens that the income bracket in which many small business owners are in is skewed towards higher income brackets, like, what's the problem? If the goal is to help small businesses, that's the goal.
Sure. But as Professor Otter mentioned, and I'm also so grateful for his research because it goes so much farther than a journalist really can with our, the tools that we have available. 500 employees is not that small of a business. And there were many loopholes and exceptions that allowed even bigger businesses to qualify. Mm-hmm. And, journalists spend their time looking at specific businesses, not just businesses in the aggregate, which allow you to see the types of folks that were taking advantage of this program that maybe didn't really need to. And I'll just
You've done great reporting on this. Give us an example.
Yeah, well, so one story we did was about public companies, because they're the only type of company that we as outsiders, members of the public, actually have visibility into. And there weren't, as a share of the overall number of businesses that took the money that didn't need it, it's probably small. But I looked at them because that's the only thing I have access to, right? They're public filings. And so there's another study that found, or it was around 800 publicly traded companies that took out PPP loans. And some of them probably did need it, right? Like if you're clearly you can no longer function because of pandemic restrictions, like you're a restaurant or a hotel or a travel business, like I get it. Even if you're big, it probably helped you survive. But there are other companies like a large dealership of RVs, which actually benefited tremendously from the pandemic because people wanted to get an RVs and go all around the country, got the max, close to the maximum loan. It was almost all forgiven. And they did gangbusters business. Or similarly, a chain of dealerships of other types of, what are they called, like ATVs and fun outside vehicles. They got a big loan. Startup biotech companies that have been funded by investors their entire existence, which probably would have continued doing what they were doing absent the money, but they got it anyway. And because money is fungible, technically it goes to pay payroll, but the money that you would have otherwise used to pay payroll goes to do other things, whether it's buy other companies or simply, pay for yachts for the business owner. There were all kinds of things that did not violate the rules of the program. But if you look at it, you kind of think, really, was that what this program was meant to do?
Right. So I think that's a great encapsulation of this. Lots of instances in which no one violated the rules of the program. But I'm just directly quoting you here. But was it the best use of the money? I mean, I'm looking at one of your stories right now, Lydia. Lazy Days Holdings, a publicly traded collection of RV dealerships. They got $9 million in PPP funding. At the end of 2019, they actually had, even before the pandemic, more than $30 million in cash on hand. And then during the pandemic, their stock price shot up by more than $500. And ultimately found that ProPublica found that $250 million of PPP funding, at least that, went to companies, publicly traded companies with growing revenues.
Right. And these are rough measures, right? It's like really hard for us to say whether or not you really needed the money. It's like a tough counterfactual to prove, but we just thought it was sort of indicative. And you know, the SBA was overwhelmed. Like, it did millions of these loans, was in charge of putting out $800 billion onto the street. And it did not have the systems to police everything, which is why they funneled it through banks, which are supposed to have these systems in place to do so. But it really did not ask the banks to do much in the way of verifying need. And Professor Otter mentioned what they had to sort of testify to, that it wasn't even that they needed the money or that they were adversely impacted. It was simply they had to check a box saying that the current uncertainty makes this loan necessary for the continuation of the business. And so the SBA said, all right, if you got more than $2 million, later on we'll come back and check if that was really true. And when they started to do that by making these big borrowers fill out questionnaires with more information about their financial conditions, general contractors, actually their association, like construction companies, sued saying, this is not what you promised. You just said this was free money. All and uncertainty covers a huge number of circumstances. How dare you question our eligibility for this money? And the SBA backed down. And so there was essentially no check on whether a company realistically might have needed the money. And there were companies that just maybe because of the risk of public opprobrium gave it back. They paid it back. It's still useful.
Yeah, I remember those stories. Right.
Yeah, but that was a very small minority, and only if you really had any risk of public exposure did you do that.
So hang on here for just a second, because David Otter, I want to come back to you and link what Lydia is saying to some other findings here in this paper that that you co-authored. You say in the paper that, again, we're talking about the structure of the American economy and the structure of who wage earners are and where they fall in terms of various quintiles here. And you say that even though PPP only offered loans to support up to $100,000 in annual earnings for workers, right? But even with that cap, it's the top fifth of households that account for 35% of wage and salary earnings. So they're disproportionately though at that top $100,000 mark. And then more importantly, you say that the distribution of ownership essentially is more skewed towards higher owners. You say the top fifth of households command 86% of capital income, meaning that subsidies to businesses are ultimately subsidies to high-income households. Now, tease that apart for us, because does this not then shine a light on the challenge in the PPP program where, you know, first 75% and then 60% was supposed to be for wages, but the difference then businesses could spend on other expenses?
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. The distribute 85% of kind of capital ownership is accrued to the top fifth of households. So whenever you're giving money to businesses, you're first handing it to those households. Now, if they had used it all to pay wages that they wouldn't otherwise have paid, then ultimately we'd say, well, they didn't get to keep the money, so it wouldn't have been such a big benefit to them. But as we estimate, only a quarter to a third of PPP dollars ultimately went to workers who would have otherwise lost jobs. So that means the remainder, stayed with those businesses. Now, they used it for a variety of things, right? They used it to pay their suppliers. They used it to buy equipment. But as Lydia emphasized, many of them just became a great deal more profitable. And it's also the case that those payments ultimately, after the fact, Congress made them assign no tax liability to them. So let's say you were a business that before PPP, you earned $1 million in revenue, you paid $700,000 to workers and suppliers, and then you had $300,000 in profits remaining, and you would pay tax on that. Well, let's say during the pandemic, you lost all your revenue, but you got $1 million loan from PPP, and you used $700,000 to pay workers and suppliers, and you had $300,000 remaining. Well, that would be profit, but you wouldn't be taxed on it because PPP income would not be taxed. So it's actually, we don't even account for this in the paper, but another $85 billion actually went to the top 20% of households through this ex post tax windfall.
Wow. Okay. So David Autor at MIT and Lydia DePillis from ProPublica, hang on here for just a second. We are talking today about where the money, where the $800 billion in the Paycheck Protection Program actually went. And once we understand that, how do we judge the success of the program and what needs to change next time a disaster hits and emergency funds need to be dispersed? So we'll talk a lot more about that second question when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a heads up on what we're talking about tomorrow, school masking. Yes, we are going to talk about school masking because a whole slew of governors in the past several days have said they are going to relax their statewide mask mandates for schools. And a lot of folks are really happy about this. Some public health officials agree. They say it's the right time for kids to be able to take masks off in schools. The CDC said no. Other public health officials also say this is not, in fact, the right time. So parents and teachers, kids even, we really want to hear from you. How do you want your school to move forward with masking policy? What has life been like for the past 2 years with you to mask up every time you go to school, whether to teach, to work, or to learn? What would you like to happen next? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And also call us with your questions. What do you want to know about school masking? 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are asking the question, where did the money go with the $800 PPP program that was intended to preserve jobs and help small businesses in this country? And I'm joined by David Autor. He's a professor of economics at MIT. He led a team of 10 economists in answering this question. They have a paper called The Paycheck Protection Program. Where did the money go and why did it go there? Lydia DePillis also joins us. She's a reporter from ProPublica who has been reporting on PPP for quite some time. So David and Lydia, just hang on here for a second, because like I said, we got a lot of feedback from listeners about the Paycheck Protection Program. Here's Mary Kessler from Rhode Island. She owns a shop that makes wooden art pieces, and they sell to galleries, gift shops, museums, and craft shows.
When the pandemic hit, all of our sales channels stopped. We received two PPP loans for a total of about $30,000. They were a lifeline. For us, the application process was fairly straightforward. We were able to pay our employees and our rent. The PPP loans have both been forgiven. There has never been a time when our government so supported us. I'm not sure how we would have stayed in business without it. We are one very small business still moving forward, thanks in part to the PPP.
That's Mary in Rhode Island. Another listener called us and said he was not happy with how his company used the PPP funds it received. He wanted to remain anonymous because his industry is very small, and he said if he were identified, he might face consequences at work.
I was an employee in good standing for 10 years, was put on a temporary layoff at the dawn of COVID. The company I had been working for received a large amount of PPP money. Rather than bringing those of us back who were temporarily laid off and full-time employees, they chose to use the PPP money to give gig worker, part-time employees, a paycheck advance that was taxable.
All right, that's another listener who gave us a call. Now, I want to actually spend a little time hearing in more detail from a business owner. So we reached out to Alexis Percival. She's a co-owner of a small restaurant group in New York City. They have two restaurants, Kindred and Ruffian. And March 2020, as COVID shut down New York, Alexis told us that her restaurants started hemorrhaging money immediately. And her group didn't know if they'd be able to stay in business longer than a week.
The thing that we kept telling ourselves was, like, there has to be help coming. They have to do something. Like, we're in collapse.
They knew they'd have to close, at least temporarily, which meant laying off some of their staff. So they helped their employees navigate the unemployment insurance system. And in late May, Percival and her co-owners applied for funding from PPP. It was a complex, labyrinthine process, challenging enough in itself. But Alexis says it worked for her. Their first successful application in 2020 yielded around $300,000 for both restaurants. In March 2021, they applied again. Her group applied again and received $420,000. But having the loan approved and getting the actual cash were two different things. So Alexis told us she approached the group's longtime bank and asked if the loan could be processed there. But the bank said they couldn't help.
We had an existing bank that we use for everything at both restaurants. And that was not who our lending came from. They claimed that the money had already been distributed.
Another hurdle, maintaining payroll, a requirement, as we've discussed, if the loan was to be forgiven. Her restaurants employed about 30 people total. And as we mentioned, prior to closing, Alexis and her fellow owners had helped their staff apply for unemployment. And at the time, that meant her staff was receiving an extra $600 a month for workers through that unemployment assistance. So it didn't make sense for some of them to come back to work. And Alexis says the group did spend 70% of their first PPP loan on payroll, the rest in rent and utilities. For their second loan, they spent 60% on payroll. But again, that matches the program's requirements, the changes in the program's requirements. So the other 40% went to rent, utilities, food and wine vendors, and the construction of an outdoor dining area.
Like a lot of businesses, both in and out of the restaurant industry, your vendors provide you credit terms, so your bills aren't due for 30 days. But they do come due. Our landlords have been great. They did work with us. But rent, obviously, New York City, the rent is too damn high. So that was a major consideration. There's always things. There's you owe your contractors money for build outs. There's always stuff.
Alexis also says she and three other owners, her fellow owners, sometimes stop paying themselves in order to stay afloat.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. We put ourselves on unemployment twice. We took pay cuts. Yeah. Yep. That's always the first thing we think of. I try to kind of minimize the impact on the staff as much as possible while, you know, we're a young partnership. We have responsibilities and rent too.
Alexis did also tell us, though, that PPP saved her business two times over, and she doesn't know what would have happened if the money hadn't come through. So that's Alexis Percival, co-owner of Ruffian and Kindred Restaurants in New York City. So, Lydia, before we get to sort of lessons learned here, can you just quickly remind us why the rules did change for PPP in terms of what businesses had to do in order to qualify for the loan forgiveness?
Yeah, rules changed iteratively throughout most of the year. The SBA was constantly putting out new guidance. And usually in response to a business lobby saying, hey, we need more flexibility on this. And that would translate into lawmakers who would, there was a whole, you know, new law passed called the PPP Flexibility Act, which I think extended the time over which businesses could use the money. Functionally, though, that made it so that they didn't have to maintain employment as much as they would have otherwise. And their case was, we have other costs. And if you want us to survive, we're going to need some latitude here to pay for other expenses that we have. And that was a trade-off that was made. And there were other organizations lobbying against some of those changes because it meant the program became less powerful as a way to support employees. And unions were the biggest proponents of not making those changes because it was really important, especially for the hotel unions, for example, that their workers maintain their attachment to their employers because this meant keeping their benefit packages intact. The business that you talk to faced this trade-off of, well, it's sometimes more profitable for our employees to go on unemployment than for us to keep them on payroll. And I think that was sort of a problem with program design. There were other countries like Germany and actually most regimes in Europe, which, I mean, many other countries did similar business support programs. But the way they set them up is, we will pay your payroll on the condition that your workers are not working. And this was like a contradiction that a lot of U.S. businesses struggled with. It's like, why would we keep people on payroll if there's nothing for them to do? Uh-huh. It sort of cuts against like the American ideal of why would we pay people for doing things that aren't necessary? And, the answer is, in Europe, they just decided it was better to keep people attached to their employers and it would allow them to recover and reopen more quickly rather than having to rehire everyone and letting those skills deteriorate.
Right. So can I just jump in here? So this seems to be one of the lessons learned then, because we got a comment from a guy on Twitter who said, would it have been cheaper for the government to pay workers directly? I mean, David Otter, what do you think about that? Could you now imagine a different kind of program that takes into account what Lydia said, like perhaps the government paying workers directly if they don't have a job but are still attached to their employer, and then separately funds to keep the businesses themselves afloat?
Right. And this goes to the heart of the painful trade-off that Congress faced, because the U.S. does not have the administrative capacity to do exactly what Lydia was talking about, what Germany did, what Canada did, what most of Western Europe did, which was basically to say, to be able to monitor business payroll in real time and say, okay, you've reduced hours by 30%, so we will pay that other 30% for you, or your revenues are down, so we will give you a subsidy. The U.S. has completely antiquated and slow-moving administrative systems that have basically deteriorated over the course of at least four decades when we've been disinvesting in them. And so the U.S. could not move nimbly to do what these other countries did. And so the only way that Congress could figure out to get the money out quickly was basically to open the fire hose and just spray the entire small business sector with money. And it couldn't actually originate those loans itself. It didn't have the capacity for that either.
Yeah, but can I just jump in here? The timeliness was part of the factor, though. Like they couldn't wait 6 months to get the money.
Absolutely.
The crisis was happening in days. Yeah.
The timeliness was crucial. And if it had moved slower, it would have been less effective. So they made the correct choice, given what they're doing, to use the private sector, to use banks to originate. Eventually these, Blue Acorn and Womply and these, new finance organizations shot up. And they did distribute an enormous amount of money in a very short period of time. But, what we say in the paper, I think this is, kind of encapsulates it, the government didn't have a fire extinguisher to put out the fire. And so it just opened a fire hose instead. Uh-huh. And everything got sprayed.
And the catch is up here, because when you talk about basically decrepit administrative bureaucracy, you're talking about everything from like computer code and technology to the extant organizations the federal government has to keep that that information coming in real time so we can be more targeted?
Oh, yeah. Even the data systems. I mean, So basically, you know, how does the government figure out who's working, who's, you know, in detail? It gets unemployment insurance records from states ex post. The states run them. The unemployment insurance systems are running on COBOL code that was written 50 years ago. They practically had to exhume programmers to just add the $600 payments as part of the pandemic unemployment insurance. The reason it was $600.
COBOL? Sorry.
COBOL.
From like literally half a century ago.
Literally a half a century ago. So in the Y2K, they were scrambling for COBOL programmers to, you know, deal with to update computer code at banks. It's the same code. Woefully inadequate. So, you know, people, you know, why does U.S. have such terrible administrative systems? Well, two reasons. One is we've not spent the money. The other is this fear, this creeping fear that the government, you know, will have too much info. And people worry a lot about the deep state. I worry a lot about the shallow state. The fact that we've lost so much administrative capacity that we can't actually do the necessary things of governing. And the design of the Paycheck Protection Program was exactly about to that reality.
Okay.
We couldn't act nimbly. And so we had a choice of either doing very little or doing way too much in an untargeted way.
So we have 3 minutes left. And Lydia and David, I want to hear from both of you of like, okay, there will be another disaster. And hopefully the United States will have a system of government at that time that allows the federal government to provide assistance. So what lessons, Lydia? You get to go first. Do you think we should be drawing from where the money went with PPP this time, and what would you change for next time?
Yeah, well, so what Professor Otter is talking about in terms of administrative capacity is totally right. And I think that part of it is it's been neglected, but another part of it is literally by design, right? Because there's a strong strain in America of we do not want government knowing much about our businesses. There's a Treasury proposed having the IRS have access to a little bit more transaction data this past year. Mm-hmm. And it was politicized to such a degree that the proposal was, I think, dropped. Because Republicans spun it into this idea that the IRS is going to be like surveilling you. And of course, the IRS knows a lot about you, but they're not able to act on it in a way that would allow sort of more finely tuned relief programs. So it's both, we should probably have more continuous reporting so that we know kind of we can keep tabs on this stuff, which would make honestly tax filing a lot easier as well. And make it compliance a lot higher.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, is some folks have proposed a more explicitly focused reconstruction bank institution that could handle these kinds of programs, right? Because as we did it, they were spread out across the IRS, the SBA, and like totally ad hoc organizations that, for example, like spewed tens of billions of dollars at the airline industry.
Right.
And so, you know, Germany had this kind of thing coming out of World War II because they needed to rebuild their country. You know, people have proposed this for a long time that we should have an institution that is in place explicitly for emergencies, because the emergency capacity of many of our other institutions is not up to the task.
Well, can I just jump in here? Because we have mm-hmm. FEMA. So why not have like an economic emergency,
sure.
you know, organization? I totally hear what you're saying. I just want to give Professor Otter the last 30 seconds, which is all we have left. And Professor, sure. It sounds like PPP was a success, but a really inefficient and expensive one that while it helped some workers, also helped the richest Americans. So what would you do?
Sure. Yeah, it compares very unfavorably to either the household payments, the stimulus checks, or the pandemic unemployment insurance. But if there's one thing I would change, it's that I would rebuild our unemployment insurance program so that it used modern data systems and integrated nationally. And that way we could do what European countries do, which is short time work. Instead of having employers fire people to collect UI, they could reduce their hours and the government would make up part of the difference during a downturn. And if we had that system in place, we would use it often. And we would have been able to use it during the pandemic.
Well, you know, I know it doesn't sound sexy, but administrative modernization may go a long, long way in this country to make us more efficient and more equitable. So David Otter, professor of economics at MIT and co-author of this major paper about the Paycheck Protection Program, Where Did the Money Go? Thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you, Meghna. And nice to meet you, Lydia.
And Lydia DePillis, reporter at ProPublica. Thank you for all your reporting, Lydia.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.